Welcome to Melungeon Voices Podcast. I'm your cruise director, Liz Malone, here once again with the president of the Melungeon Heritage Association, Heather Andalina. Heather, how are you today?
I'm doing very well. How are you, Liz?
I look forward to any excuse to get to talk to you again, Heather.
I know.
It's called social distancing, people.
We're staying safe.
So for this week's episode, you had a very interesting conversation with a fascinating woman, Beverly Scarlett. So I'm sure everybody is dying to know a little bit about our new friend, Beverly.
Yes, Liz. Beverly Scarlett is a district court judge and author with over 36 years of genealogical research into her Harris family history. Her book, The Harris Family of Orange County, North Carolina, 318 Years of Black American Indian Culture, is due out this summer for direct purchase from Lulu Publishers. All proceeds from her book will benefit the nonprofit Indigenous Memories. During our discussion, she shares her personal journey in uncovering her hidden roots, which later help to shape her future writing.
Great. Let's take a listen.
Hi, Beverly.
Hello, Heather.
The first question I have for you is that you have a very fascinating story on how you got interested in researching your ancestry. Can you tell us what happened?
Yes, Heather. I'm very happy to share that story. I was actually packing to go away to college, and I was scrounging, literally just digging in my parents' attic to find anything I could take in place of my dorm room. And I came across a portrait of a person that appeared to me to be an Indian man. I took the portrait downstairs to the kitchen where my mother cooked, and I asked her, who is this Indian man and why are you hiding an Indian in the attic? And I got a very short, curt response that was unlike my mother or my experience with my mother, that essentially said, that is not a man, that is my grandmother, put that back and don't ever touch it again. And of course, that caused me to want to know more. And after I went to college and earned my mother's trust, of course, I went to St. Augustine's College in Raleigh, which is a historically Black college, and got exposed to a lot of Black culture that I hadn't been exposed to. Black writers, one in particular, Charles Chestnut, my favorite story. I think it's The Wife of His Youth, but it's a story about a man in slavery and he escapes and his wife never remarries and she looks for him. And of course, she eventually finds him, doesn't recognize him, and he has a very different life and is about to propose to someone else. But more importantly, the story gets into the stratification within communities of color because his wife was a very dark-skinned lady and he is a very fair person. And so that just intrigued me. And I wanted to know more about my family because I knew from family reunions that we went from the lightest light to the darkest dark, and nobody ever talked about the color variation. We weren't allowed to. And so eventually I earned my mother's trust and she started to talk, but that's how it all began.
Beverly, that is a very fascinating story. I love that story. So how or when did you learn about the Melungeon people?
That is very interesting. So I learned of the Melungeon people, it's actually been fairly recently, I would say within the last 5 or 6 years, just following up on my mother's story and preparing to write the book that I've written. I knew that I live in a tri-race racial isolate, but it's one that people don't talk about, probably don't know about. And so I was Googling triracial isolates one day, and the story of the Melungeon people came up. And of course, you read one story and it's fascinating, and you follow another link and you follow another link. And then I end up with the Melungeon Heritage Association, and I told my mom about it. And she was like, yeah, let's go ahead and join. And so I immediately enrolled myself, my mother, and my daughter.
That is wonderful. Well, that leads me into my next question, which is about your book, The Harris Family of Orange County, North Carolina, 318 Years of Black American Indian Culture. In your book, you do discuss the Harris family, but you also discuss other Melungeon families like the Collinses as well. Can you tell our listeners more about your family ancestry and its connections to the Melungeon people?
Yes, I am happy to share that. So a part of my process of verifying my mother's stories, of course, it wasn't that I didn't believe my mom, but probably because of my employment, I have to be able to verify. But I, of course, joined Ancestry.com, and I followed the lead of my great-grandmother's name, and it took me a while to find my great-grandparents on the census because they had Sally's husband, Frank, listed as Black, Sally listed as a mulatto, but they didn't have them listed as being married. And now I have more information. I totally understand why, and especially in light of people like Walter Petler and the eugenics movement, although that comes later, it's just the way people viewed people, and everything was based on color. But following these leads, and I find Sally living in a household at the age of 13, and the head of the household is Alan Collins, his wife Elizabeth Collins, and then there is, there's Nancy, but there's a daughter, yes, Nancy, I can't remember her, maybe Strayhorn, I can't remember her name right now off the top of my head. And then there is a child, and then there is Nanny Collins, and then Sally Ray. And Sally Ray is the only mulatto in that household, according to the census. So I follow up on Nancy, and I find where Nancy had been married. I find that her husband was killed. The young person in the household has a name as the husband, and I did the math, and it's very likely that he is the son of a former spouse, not Nancy. And so I start looking at the ages, and, the head of the household is the oldest, and it comes right on down to Sally being 13, but nobody explains why this one mulatto, and this is before the Civil War, is living in this household with alleged white people. And I have a relative in Hampton, Virginia, that put me in contact with Scott Collins. And so I emailed Scott several times. We formed a good relationship, and he started to tell me about the history of the Collinses. And he says, Beverly, says we're mixed race people, and said it's very likely that Alan passed as white so he could help other people. And lo and behold, as I pull up other census reports on Alan, every 10 years there's somebody else different in his household. And so I said, I believe Scott is absolutely right. And so from there, I journey to our state archives in Raleigh, and I get Orange County's first tax rolls. And there are Collins and Gibson's. And of course, I know the story about Vardy and Buck because I've read that online. That's like the best story of my life, hearing that. And I did more digging and found out that Vardy, of course, bought land there in Tennessee, but he also had a lawsuit in the western part of North Carolina. And I figure out that based on my research and my math, and I'm not a mathematician, so it may not be exactly correct, but it's close enough, I think, that Vardy had land in what is now Tennessee, but used to be the far western portion of North Carolina. And that's where his lawsuit is filed, because he can only file in the state where he has land or some other form of standing. And of course, most of the people coming into North Carolina came via Virginia, straight down, not far from where I currently live now, and then they walk across. And so that's how I made the connection.
That is so cool. I myself have Collins and Gibson in my family. So when I read that in your book, I was like, this is really cool. It helps me with my research as well. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. That's exciting to hear. And the other fascinating piece is that when we look at the numbers year-wise, they sound so very long ago. But if you think about generation-wise and people aging and having children and grandchildren, it's really not that long ago.
No, you're right. It isn't. It isn't. Beverly, were there any surprises for you while you were doing research on your family?
Yes, there were several. So the most noted surprise for me was learning about a cemetery that is literally a stone's throw from where I live. And I must admit, the cemetery is not referenced in the book, but it will be in volume number 2. And it is a cemetery of my family, mainly, so I thought at the time I wrote the book, I thought my mother's father's side of the family. Well, I've learned since writing the book that it's her family, my mother's mother's family, my mother's father's family as well. But that cemetery has Native American and African Americans buried in the same spot. And the reason I know there is a clear definition in the markers, they're all rock, but you can clearly see what's river rock. You can clearly see what's field rock. And one of the more recent burials, which would be my mother's father's grandfather, he actually has a tombstone. And I think he was interred in 1909 or 1910, and he lived to be like 106 years old. But he actually has what we would consider a headstone, and he's at the back. So if when you look at the front, it's just a sea of beautiful river rock, field rock, and it's fascinating. So I'm trying to learn more about this little triracial isolate. Another surprise was learning that the Indian trading path that typically follows what we know as Interstate 85, it actually veered and came right along where I live and that is St. Mary's Road. It pretty much took you, let's see, something that people would recognize is the area of Stagville Plantation, and it brings you right to Hillsboro. But just before you get to Hillsboro, it makes a sharp left, goes down what is now Pleasant Green Road, and connects to I-85. Now, this trading path in the area where I live today was actually the road to the Catawba Nation. And so there was a lot of trading with Europeans, Indians. It all happened right here along this road. And I was just like, oh, my goodness, that's one of the surprises, but also one of the most fascinating things ever.
That is very fascinating. Do you feel that you're finished researching your family ancestry, or is there still some rocks to be looked under? So this was your mother's side. Have you looked at your father's side?
Yes and yes. I will continue to research. I know this is just my view, but I think I have the good fortune to be living upon and raised upon land that is so rich with culture that we could dig for years and not learn it all. I grew up on a tobacco farm. So, of course, part of that farming meant turning the land, turning the land, turning the land. And I remember as a child, my mother was what we call the arrowhead magnet. And, you know, she'd just walk out in the field after it's been plowed and she'd have a handful of arrowheads, and my sisters and I would be looking, and you know, we might find one once every 5 or 6 years, and she could just go find them. And she told me the land had always been rich in arrowheads, and that is what she and her siblings used as currency. And they would be able to purchase candy, a little 5-10 cent toy. So there is so much more research to be done here. And additionally, I mentioned in the places section of my book two prominent plantations that are along the road where I live now. One is Hardscrabble Plantation, and that was a plantation that was actually owned by a very wealthy man who had worked in the North Carolina legislature prior to the Civil War. And of course, once war broke out, his plantation went belly up pretty quickly. But then there was also the Lipscomb Plantation, and a lot of my mother's relatives were connected to both of those plantations. Number one, the Lipscomb Plantation, my mother's uncle actually worked that plantation. His wife worked that plantation. And then Hardscrabble Plantation, I still have a relative that lives on that land now. But the uncle at Lipscomb's son ended up being the keeper of that plantation till he died, and then his son kept it. And so now the grandson is just living there. They've made it a housing development, but he's just living there. So there's a whole lot more for me to learn and dig, and I'm very excited about it. I am going to do a second volume that will focus also on my mother's father's family. And as to my father's family, this was an interesting thing to find out. And that is my mother and father are, I think, fourth cousins. So my dad is connected to the cemetery, the indigenous cemetery, where we have Native Americans and African Americans buried together. So my parents grew up 7 miles from each other, though they did not know each other until they were introduced at church. So it's just lots of information. My dad's family has always been along the Eno River. And of course, we have a lot of Native American culture along the Eno River. But for some reason in my dad's family, they never embraced any amount of their Native American heritage. You'd have to pin them to the wall for them to even admit it, and then they'd get tight-lipped. So they only embrace their African American heritage.
That's interesting. What was it like for you upon learning about your Saponi ancestry?
Earlier, I spoke about my mom's family having such color variation. It's color variation, hair texture variation. I mean, it was just a beautiful, fascinating rainbow. So I knew, compared to most of my dad's family, that something was different. I also knew something was different just starting out in separate and unequal schools. You know, all the colored kids went to school together, and we later transitioned to be Black kids, but we all went to school together. But my mother's family just had so much more color variation. So I knew there was something there, but my mother would not talk about it until she was much older. As a matter of fact, when we go to my mom's family reunion, my sister and I would always laugh and say, we're going to the United Nations meeting. Of course, we never told her that, but that was our joke among ourselves. And for me, I always wanted to know more. And once I could empower my mother and she started to talk, it became a mission for her. And once we enrolled in the Saponi Nation of Ohio, my mom became very excited about it. And up until the point that she could not physically attend the cultural meetings anymore, my mom went, and she is excited to go. And so it's one of those things that we've come into later in life. And when I questioned my mother about it, she told me, she said, we always knew, and said there were certain people in the community that knew, said, but other than that, if you acknowledge any Indian heritage, you would be hurt or killed, because there were not supposed to be any more Indians around here.
Well, Beverly, that was very interesting. Do you have any words of wisdom for our listeners who may find a mysterious photo in their attic?
Yes, I do. Inquire, ask, research, delve, and don't ever be afraid. This has been the most wonderful, most empowering journey for me. I think particularly given the state of racial politics in the USA right now, I think the more we dig and find out who we are and find out we really are blended, it'll be easier to have conversations that we think are tough conversations. They're really not tough conversations. We just need to have them. One thing I can say about the southeastern part of the United States, it will be rare to find somebody who's 100% anything other than human being. So explore, research, the humanity itself is such a wonderful thing. And I consider people just a portion of a beautiful flower garden or bouquet. And we all have a part to play, and we're more beautiful when we're all in this thing together. So yeah, dig, research, ask the questions, and don't ever give up.
I love that, Beverly, and I wholeheartedly agree with you 100%. Beverly, I just want to say a big thank you for you being on our podcast, Melungeon Voices, and hopefully we will see you next year where you can do a presentation for at next year's union.
Heather, thank you so much. And thanks again for allowing me to participate. Joining the Melungeon Heritage Association has empowered me. I love the journey and I'm willing to do whatever I can to help. So thanks so much.
You've been listening to the Melungeon Voices podcast. On behalf of myself, Heather Andalina, and the entire MHA Executive Committee, we'd like to thank all of those who participated in making this episode possible. For more information, you can visit them on the web at melungeon.org. That's melungeon.org. The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast episode do not necessarily represent those of the MHA. Melungeon Voices is presented by the Melungeon Heritage Association. All rights are reserved.